Today at Reader's Corner, Steve Faneroo, author of League of Denial, the NFL, Concussions, and the Battle for Truth.
CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, literally brain damage that's caused by repeated head trauma. It was never diagnosed in a football player until Bennett Omalu opened up Mike Webster's skull and examined his brain. Webster was the first NFL player to be diagnosed with the disease. There's now been 54 brains of deceased NFL players that have been examined, and 52 of those have been found to have CTE. That's a staggering number to many neuroscientists, particularly those who are most intimately involved in this issue.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Iron Mike Webster was one of the most revered and beloved Pittsburgh Steelers of all time. The Hall of Fame center was a tough, hardworking, and disciplined player who gave everything he had to football. But after retiring from the NFL in 1990, he suffered a severe decline in both physical and mental health. When he died 12 years later at age 50, his body made one of its most significant contributions to the sport and to the fellow players he loved. A look at Iron Mike's brain showed signs of permanent brain damage, presumably from the numerous concussions he endured, and it set off a battle between neuroscientists and the NFL about whether football causes brain damage. A new book titled League of Denial, The NFL, Concussions, and the Battle for Truth documents the discovery, denial, and finally the NFL's reckoning with the concussion issue. Today's guest, ESPN investigative reporter Steve Faneroo, wrote the book with his brother Mark Faneroo Wada, who also works for ESPN. Mr. Faneroo is a former Washington Post reporter and the recipient of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for his investigation into the U.S. military's reliance on private security contractors. Steve Faneroo was a guest on this show in 2010 to discuss his previous book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, and he spoke at Boise State that same year as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series. He joins us today by phone for this interview. Steve Faneroo, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be back.
Well, as I was saying before we got on the air here, I really enjoyed your book. Some of it is very distressing and sad, but it's a story that needs to be told. Al Toon, Dave Duerson, Steve Young, Brett Favre, Merrill Hodge, Junior Seau, Jim McMahon, all of these are names that most people, even if you don't follow pro football every week, you've heard a good number of those names. They've all come up in relation to concussions. Some of them have died prematurely. Your book tries to tell this tale, but we don't have time to talk about all of them. But let's just focus on Mike Webster. Take us inside Mike Webster's retirement years and how this led to the discovery it did.
Sure. So Mike, when he got out of the NFL, even before he left the NFL in the early 90s, he began to change. His family noticed it first. He was very irresponsible with money. He was prone to flashes of anger. He had severe memory problems. And over a relatively short period of time, his family really watched him lose his mind. He became more and more sort of divorced from reality. He ended up living in his pickup truck for long periods of time, just sort of wandering between Wisconsin and Pittsburgh. He spent a lot of time hanging out in bookstores and writing thousands, literally thousands of notes that Mark and I read, in which he tried to describe what was happening to him. And he knew on some level that his brain had been severely altered, and he believed that it was related to his career in the NFL. And in the end, he ultimately blamed the NFL and became so addled that he, his anger manifested itself to the point where he fantasized about killing NFL officials and Pittsburgh Steelers officials. Mike died at the age of 50 in 2002, and his brain, coincidentally, was examined by a pathologist who was working in the Allegheny County Coroner's Office named Bennett Omalu, who had just finished his neuropathology studies. And Omalu he knew nothing about football, but he had read a little bit about what happened to Webster, and he began to explore. He decided he wanted to examine Webster's brain. So he literally saved it in a bath of formaldehyde and water. And what he found was exactly what you described, this neurodegenerative disease that's now known as CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And it's literally brain damage that's caused by repeated head trauma. And Omalu believed, and other scientists who that he was affiliated with believed, that disease was related to Webster's 17-year career in the NFL. And that touched off a series of events that's led us to really where we are now, which is where the issue of concussions is being widely discussed and debated throughout the country.
So is CTE now accepted by the medical community as a fact of science, and does the NFL agree?
Well, CTE has been around for a long time. The CTE is just basically brain damage caused by head trauma, and it's been known, for example, in boxers since the 1920s. It was never diagnosed in a football player until Bennett Omalu opened up Mike Webster's skull and examined his brain. Webster was the first NFL player to be diagnosed with the disease. There's now been, I believe, 54 brains of deceased NFL players that have been examined, and 52 of those have been found to have CTE. Now, that's a staggering number to many neuroscientists, particularly those who are most intimately involved in this issue. The NFL, to this day, I wouldn't say that they're denying it anymore, but they are refusing to make that connection. They're sort of deferring to the medical community. And so now there's a debate about how much study do you need before you can assert categorically that one thing is caused by the other. People like Bennett Omalu, Julian Bales, who's a former Steelers neurosurgeon, Ann McKee, who's at Boston University, and numerous others believe that the numbers are overwhelming, that this is obvious, and that there's a sort of a common sense science behind it as well. But some people in the NFL are still reluctant to draw that causation. And so there's a debate now about how much study is needed. At the same time, while many people feel like we're well beyond that and this is settled science.
And one of the issues seems to be the concussion itself. What are the short or long-term effects? And I guess historically, it was all about short-term. People thought, oh, well, you know, let the guy sit out for a couple of plays, he goes back in, everything's fine. Now we know differently.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this is one of the things that I think was really interesting for Mark and me when we were researching the book, that not only was the issue regarded as a minor issue in the NFL for decades and decades, that it really wasn't regarded as a major issue in the medical community until sort of starting around the mid-80s, when studies that originated around car crash victims and began to spread into contact sports began to show that concussions, in fact, were not minor injuries, that many people suffer concussions and have lingering effects for weeks, months, years, and even sometimes permanently. And so what's really been revelatory, I think, about what's going on in the NFL now is that many people, like Ann McKee, the neuroscientist at Boston University, they believe that it's not just the one-time impact that is setting off this this disease, that it's the repetition of contact that's endemic to football that's creating this problem. And that poses, obviously, you know, existential problems for the NFL, because how do you take the head contact out of the sport when you have increasingly large, strong, powerful, and fast men at the line of scrimmage banging into each other on every play, not to mention the collisions that we all see, the dramatic collisions that happen in the open field. They believe that it's the sort of repetition that's occurring that might not even result in a concussion as it's defined. They call them subconcussive blows, that might be causing this buildup of this deadly protein that ultimately leads to the disease.
You're listening to Steve Faneroo. He's the author of League of Denial, The NFL Concussions and the Battle for Truth. His brother is his co-author. That would be Mark Faneroo Wada. And then there's the culture of the game and the mentality of the players themselves. You cite Merrill Hodge, who actually has an Idaho connection. He's a Pocatello boy,
right,
who went on to be Mike Webster's teammate on the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I believe he tried to explain to you just what it's like being a player and having to decide what to do if you feel you do have something like that happen to you.
Well, right. So Merrill Hodge, you know, is a really dramatic case, and his case ultimately had a you know, a big impact on the evolution of this science. So Hodge came out of, as you said, Pocatello, and you know, he was not a very big or fast guy. His game was all about toughness and consistency and staying out on the field. And he would, like Webster, who had taught him this, you know, he would do anything that he could to stay out on the field. But he began to suffer a series of concussions that left him, in the end, literally unable to remember his daughter's name. He couldn't remember who the president was. On one occasion, he was on the field in Kansas City and suffered a concussion, and the trainer asked him, "Do you know where you are?" And he said, "Tampa Bay." And they asked him why, and he said, "Well, because I can hear the ocean." So when Hodge then went back to Pittsburgh, where some of the early studies were going on to try to get his brain assessed after these series of concussions, he found that his mental capacity had dropped off by half, and it was recommended to him, and it was a recommendation that he accepted, to retire from the game at 29. But I think that culture of staying out of the field, that's something that we see today. That's something that I don't think that you're going to ever be able to legislate out of the game, because there's just too much of an incentive to stay out on the field, particularly at the NFL level, but really at all levels. There's, for one, the peer pressure that you face, the sacrificial quality about sacrificing your body that goes along with playing football. And then, of course, at the NFL level, as Merrill Hodge so articulately points out, it's a matter of survival, that these are people with, this is a job for these people, and they are supporting their families by doing this line of work. And so to take yourself off the field is to put yourself in the position of possibly being replaced. And, you know, we saw that. I live in San Francisco, and we saw that last year here, where the starting quarterback, Alex Smith, got a concussion, took himself out of the game, as he should. And while he was out, Colin Kaepernick came in and took his job, and now Smith is very successful in Kansas City, but he's gone, and he's no longer the starting quarterback here. Mm-hmm. I just think that this culture of sacrifice, of physical sacrifice, is something that is part of football, and is frankly part of the issue that mm-hmm. everybody's really having to deal with.
I would think, though, that the play itself will give you some indication whether somebody suffered a concussion. I'm sure there's concussions that nobody really sees happen, but there's a good number of them that do. And like in the NCAA now, they have this new targeting rule. And, you know, the player has to sit out the first half of the next game in addition to being ejected from the one he's playing in. So couldn't you really play with rules a little bit, not leaving it on the player, but just forcing the coaches to make those moves?
Well, this is one of the reasons why I think it's so incumbent, and one of the reasons why the NFL's denial of this issue for so long was so pernicious, is that it really, because you have this culture which is not going to change anytime soon, if ever, it's really the responsibility of the league and the trainers and the medical personnel on the sidelines and the coaches to take action. And even with the coaches, I mean, the coaches are incentivized toward risk. They want the player to play too. And so, you know, one of the issues about a concussion, I think, is that it's true. You can, in some cases, we can see a tackle that seemed to be malicious or seemed to be targeting the head, and that can be penalized. You can take dramatic action around that. And both the NCAA and the NFL are doing that. And I've seen this, you know, personally at games several times this year. The problem is partly with a concussion is that it's obviously, I mean, it's self-evident, but it needs to be said, it's an injury that occurs inside your head. And it's diagnosed through a variety of clinical symptoms. And sometimes you can hide those symptoms, and players will. What has to happen is that the trainers have to be really on the lookout for any signs that there are a problem and pull the players off the field. They have to have the power to pull the players off the field, which is not always the case. And then they have to administer neuropsychological testing immediately to find out really how their brain is functioning. And now the NFL and the NCAA have developed a series of tests. They're using a series of tests to try to do that. But it really requires aggressive action on the part of the medical personnel on the sidelines, and it's not an easy thing. You're working against, you know, an entire culture, the heat of the game. You're part of the team, and that's a very difficult thing to fight, I think.
I want to talk a little bit, Steve, about this atomic physicist that you cited in your book. You know, when I remember those old clips I see every now and then of George Halas's Chicago Bears on the Midway back in the 1920s and 30s, and they're wearing these leather helmets and they don't have any face guards, I've always assumed, now that's tough football. And, you know, we've wimped out in the 21st century. That's not nearly the kind of football that those guys were playing back then. But then I read the conclusions of this Tim Gay, this physicist who compared the 1920s, the average mass of a lineman, and the speed and the power, the difference between 1920 and 2000. Share that with us. That really does sum it all up when it comes to how different the game is and how much more dangerous the game is.
Yeah, it's pretty dramatic. So, you know, I think all of us who love football, who have watched it over a period of time, know intuitively that the players are getting bigger, stronger, and faster. And, you know, we can see that. It's just apparent every Sunday, every Saturday and Sunday. And Tim Gay is a football fan and a physicist at University of Nebraska, and he set out to try to establish what the levels of force are at the line of scrimmage, where, you know, there's enormous amounts of destructive force that are being generated on every play. And he took these variables, the size of the players, the speed of the players, the changing nature of the game and the equipment, and he calculated the amount of kinetic energy, which is the amount of destructive force that's exerted on another object, in this case an opposing player, had doubled over the last several decades. He said that it was the equivalent of, I believe, emptying the entire revolver chamber of a 357 Magnum, you know, into the defense. And on the one hand, it kind of leaves you in awe. But on the other hand, you're sort of like, what does that mean? What does that mean to someone's brain, which, no matter how muscled or how fast they are, is sitting inside their skull casing beneath the same shallow bath of cerebrospinal fluid that you and I both have? And that's a quite scary thing. You know, the NFL itself did biomechanical studies when they were trying to figure out whether they could engineer a sort of a concussion-resistant helmet. And those studies ultimately went nowhere, but the biomechanical studies that they did revealed an enormous amount of information about the violence that's taking place on the field. And they calculated that the velocity that's being generated in the open field by some of these open field hits is the equivalent of being hit in the head by a 10-pound cannonball traveling at 30 miles an hour. You know, and that's happening numerous times during the season. You know, and what does that do? I mean, what does that do to your brain? I mean, we know in a very microscopic, intimate way now, it can and has caused real damage in a significant number of players. What we don't know is, you know, sort of what the threshold is, who gets it and who doesn't. Why do some people get it and some people don't? Which players are more susceptible to it? You know, is there some kind of equipment that could mitigate the risk? All these questions. That's why I kind of feel like we're at the beginning of this, not nearly the end.
Now, when you say some kind of equipment, are you going back to the helmet design? Because I thought I came away from your book thinking that helmet design was really kind of a scam, that there's no way you're ever going to protect a player from the kind of force you've just described with a helmet that has a little something extra added to it.
Yeah, well, many scientists believe that there's no helmet that will ever be able to prevent a concussion, for the simple reason that it's an injury that takes place inside your head. You know, the NFL got itself into a lot of trouble chasing this rainbow of the helmet that would end concussions. You know, they ended up in this massive lawsuit. Riddell, the official helmet maker of the NFL, ended up in the same lawsuit and is still being sued by the players. But the concussion is a completely different injury, and what we're seeing is that the helmet in some ways contributes to it, because it's a weapon. So the players are emboldened because their heads are encased with this, you know, such sophisticated protection that, you know, they're using it. And the NFL is trying to legislate that out, and that's been an issue for years and years and years. But I think we all know that the NFL became a $10 billion a year business in large part because of these collisions. And so if you cut down on the collisions, that's going to cut down on the enormous revenue that's coming into the sport. So it's a real conundrum, I think. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Steve Fainarou. He's the co-author of League of Denial, the NFL, Concussions, and the Battle for Truth. Well, we're talking about the NFL here. I was really, really disappointed and surprised by the history of the lack of leadership on the part of the NFL. Paul Tagliabue just seemed to do everything he could to minimize the issue. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how does that happen? I mean, I guess I'm naive, but is Tagliabue just taking orders from owners who can't afford to even begin thinking about changing the game in any way? Or is this something that goes on in an NFL office and these owners really aren't from week to week clued in on where Tagliabue's going? And I'm thinking, for example, of creating a committee that's called the Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee. I mean, right off the bat, if you're going to call something like a concussion a mild traumatic brain injury committee, that gives you a pretty good idea where Tagliabue's coming from.
Right. You know, it's a really good question, and it's a question that I can't totally give you the answer to. You know, the NFL was completely uncooperative with us when we were doing our book, and we've been sort of scrupulously careful not to try to say what we thought the NFL was doing and simply to report what they were doing. But I think when you look at the evidence, at least as it's out there, and there's an enormous amount of it that we've amassed in our book, when you look at it, I think it's very difficult to not assign, you know, a huge amount of responsibility for what happened to Tagliabue. You know, he, from the very beginning, he was skeptical about this problem. He publicly called it a packed journalism issue, that when people like, you know, like Merrill Hodge and Al Toon and Chris Miller and so many others were having problems, you know, he just said, you know, look, this is an overstated problem. We've got a handle on it. It's no big deal. But there was so much public pressure. This is now back like in the early to mid-90s. There was so much public pressure, he decided to set up this committee, as you described it, this NFL research arm, which he called the Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee. And to head it, he appointed not a neuroscientist, not an expert in brain research, but a rheumatologist who also happened to be the New York Jets team doctor and ultimately became Tagliabue's personal physician. And then they packed that committee with other NFL doctors, who very few of them who had any experience in brain research, but did have a lot of experience in dealing with concussions on the sidelines. And the history of concussions was basically that they were not major injuries, that they were just dings, and players could go back in the game. And they often did with the approval and knowledge of the team doctors and trainers. So that was the setup going in. And then, of course, over a period of 16 years, the NFL published in a medical journal that was run by another NFL consultant, Mike Apuzzo, that a series of papers that just said that these are minor injuries, that players could theoretically get an infinite number of concussions and still be fine, mm-hmm. that they were okay to go back into the game immediately after suffering a concussion and still be fine, mm-hmm. That they didn't get brain damage, almost that they were like superhuman and impervious to brain damage. And so, you know, that was bad enough. But at the same time, you had a number of neuroscientists who were presenting the NFL with an alternative narrative, a completely opposite narrative, which was that this was a real problem, that this was a major problem, it was a major health issue that had implications not only for the NFL but for other contact sports and lower levels of the sport. And the NFL's response was to try to discredit their research, to attack them publicly, to try to get their research retracted. So that's the history of the NFL in a nutshell. I think based on our own knowledge of this, I do think that it was an issue that was coming out of the commissioner's office and was being managed. I don't think the owners had much knowledge of what was going on, but at the same time, we really don't know because we haven't seen any of the communication that may have happened between the commissioner's office and the owners.
Well, there is one late-breaking development that I don't think made it into your book because you had to send it to press before the NFL settled a concussion lawsuit brought by former players to the tune of $765 million. I know this is kind of a dumb question, but I assume that's not the end of it. Maybe just the beginning?
In terms of the litigation?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's interesting because the settlement was announced a week before the start of the season. And we included a little, we were able to get a little bit of it into the book, just basically the news that it happened. Mm-hmm. But we're now, I think, in week 10 of the NFL. More than half the season has gone by. And still the details of this settlement really have not been released beyond the fact that it's a $765 million settlement. So, for example, we don't know who qualifies for the settlement. We don't know what the criterion is to qualify for money that's contained in the settlement. We don't know the various illnesses that that are included in the settlement. And so there's a lot of restlessness among the former players about what exactly this means. We've already seen two lawsuits that have been filed since the settlement. I think Mark and I believe that the litigation over this issue is not over, simply because the information about it is not over. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that we now know, and hopefully our book provides a good background in sort of how we've got to where we are now. But the NFL's dealing with this issue is certainly not over. So I do think we're in the beginning. And then, of course, I think the real legacy of the suit and the issue generally as it's been playing out in the NFL is what happens at the youth level. Are parents really going to want their kids to play football? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a big debate that's going on all over the country now, obviously, about these issues. And it's a conversation that I think is taking place in almost every household where a family has a kid who's playing any form of contact sport, whether it's football or soccer or lacrosse or boxing or mixed martial arts. I mean, these are all sports that are implicated by what's been found at the NFL level and what's being learned in other sports. And I think it's going to be playing out for decades.
So do you think the NFL in recent, in coming years, will change the rules, eliminate kickoff returns, provide more protection upon contact? What's going to happen here?
I think they're already doing it. I mean, I think that, you know, it wasn't really until 2010 when the league was hauled before Congress, when Roger Goodell, the commissioner, was hauled before Congress, that they really began to take substantive action. You know, they blew up that committee that Tagliabue had formed, and that was disbanded, and it was replaced by another committee that had very serious neuroscientists involved. And then they began to change the rules, so they moved the kickoffs back. They moved the kickoffs up 5 yards, so there are fewer returns. And they believe that that's reduced the number of concussions that's taking place, particularly on that play. Everyone can see in just about every game now there's a hit that has called for because it's directly implicating the head. And the NFL is very much trying to legislate this out of the sport. There are a lot of people who are skeptical about that, but it's something that they're also trying to do at the youth level through their USA Football arm, which is the organization they support with regard to youth football. And so they're teaching this heads up campaign, which involves, you know, proper tackling. And but again, you know, football is a violent contact sport, and how much can you really do? And I think that's the real question.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, I don't have time for any more questions, but I do want to say for the record, as I was explaining to you before the show, that I'm concerned about this from the standpoint of being a university president, and I intend to share this interview with some of my colleagues who at the conference level and at the NCAA board level will have something to say about how the NCAA deals with this, because this isn't just, as you've pointed out, an NFL issue. This goes all the way down to Pop Warner.
Exactly.
And I think we all have to take a really hard look at it, and I just want to thank you for calling our attention to it at the NFL level, and I know you and your brother are probably going to be doing some work at the NCAA level, and we look forward to that and hope to have you back when that day comes.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much. Steve Fainaroo, the author of League of Denial, with his brother Mark Fainaroo Wada. It is the story of the NFL, concussions, and the battle for truth. Next week, Michael Zuckoff, author of Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival and a modern quest for lost heroes of World War II. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.